Hi, everyone. It's the Life of Jim audio podcast available on all streaming platforms, especially on Apple Podcasts. Today, we have a huge treat for you. And by the way, just to set us in space and time, it's March 18th, 2024. I'm recording this from San Bernardino County in my home. And I have an amazing guest today. Her name is Sochi Julissa Bermejo. She's the director of Women Who Submit, and she's the author of two of my favorite books that came out recently, Incantation, Love Poems for Battle Sites, and that was just released by Mouthfeel Press. And then her first book was Posada, Offerings of Witness and Refuge, and that was from Sundress Publications. I'm so excited to have her. Welcome, Sochi.
Thank you for having me. I'm excited to be here.
You're also a Macondista and you do so many things. So I'm going to read your author's biography and then hopefully you'll read for us and then we'll get into the interview. Does that sound good?
Sounds great.
Great. Sochi Julissa Bermejo is the daughter of Mexican immigrants, a former Steinbeck Fellow and Poets and Writers California Writers Exchange winner. She's received residencies from Hedgebrook, Ragdale, and National Parks Art Foundation in partnership with the Gettysburg National Military Park and Poetry Foundation, amongst others. She is the author of Posada, Offerings of Witness and Refuge by Sundress Publications. Her poem, Battlegrounds, was featured at the Academy of Arts Poets Poem a Day and on Being Poetry Unbound and the anthology Poetry Unbound, 50 Poems to Open Up Your World at W.W. Norton. Her poetry can be found at Acentos Review, Santa Fe Writers Project, and other journals. She teaches poetry and creative writing with Antioch University, MFA, and UCLA Extension. She's the director of the nonprofit Women Who Submit, an organization which empowers women identifying and non-binary writers to submit work for literary publication. Inspired by her Chicana identity, she works to cultivate love and comfort in chaotic times. Welcome, Sochi.
Thank you for having me.
You know how much I admire you. You're also, we're in Macondo together. We see each other at a lot of events. We were just in AWP and I saw you there. So it's nice to see you, I'll bet, virtually.
Yes.
What'd you just say? I'm sorry.
I said, it's always lovely to see you and talk to you and hug you. We can't hug today, but it's okay.
Virtual hug. Yeah. Lots of hearts. And so to start, do you mind reading about 5 to 7 minutes of your work so people can get a sense from whatever you want to read from, but at least some poems from Incantation, Love Poems for Battle Sites, your recent publication from Mouthfeel Press. Do you mind reading a little bit and then we'll get into the meat of the interview?
Sure. Thank you for asking me. I love that you already said a little bit about Posada. I called her my old lady yesterday, the other day. So I'm going to actually read. I don't usually read from Posada anymore, but I thought today would be a fun opportunity to read a little of this, a little of that, a little of the old, a little of the new. And this first poem, it's in Posada, and it's also in an anthology, Coiled Serpent. And so it's in this anthology, Coiled Serpent, from Tia Chucha Press, edited by Neelan Jana Banerjee, Daniel A. Olivas, and Ruben J. Rodriguez. And this came out in 2016 or 2015, the anthology. This poem was written in July 2014. I was on a little writing retreat. I had actually gotten rejected from Macondo for the first time. And a friend of mine was like, Don't get sad. Let's go do a writing retreat of our own. Let's go to the beach. So we went to Carpinteria for a long weekend in July 2014. While I was there, there was a news story that had come out about four cousins who were killed in Gaza on the beach. They were playing soccer on the beach and they were killed by shots coming from a boat in the ocean from the Israeli forces. And so that was a news story. And this was 2014. Also at the same time in the news was these children coming up from Central America and they were coming through Texas. So that was also on my mind, the young children, a lot of young men coming through on foot and coming into Texas, these four cousins who had been murdered. And then I was in, you know, Carpinteria, a beautiful beach town, watching kids learning how to be lifeguards. And this poem came to me. The Boys of Summer, Carpinteria, California, July 2014. In Carpinteria, California, a golden preteen in red shorts runs down a clouded over beach to play at junior lifeguard. He is lost in a sea of boys and girls just like him, all smiling and learning lessons on how to be safe. In Brooks County, Texas, a boy with a note pinned to his shirt addressed to an aunt in New Jersey wrestles with his mother's hopes pinned to his shoulders. Dehydration pins his cramping leg muscles together. On a beach in Gaza, four cousins play soccer. One calls Messi while another calls Neymar before the injury. The score is tied. They set up penalty kicks on the edge of the surf. A boat in the distance sets up its shot. The boy digs toes in the sand and waits for his turn to relay to a solo buoy bouncing in the water. He asks the cute and sunny blonde in line next to him, "If you could live anywhere, where would you live?" Alone in the desert, the boy lies down in the dirt. As he closes his eyes, he dreams of a home he is to build for his mother and sister, where he will watch all the TV he wants, and no one worries about being killed. On a beach in Gaza, the four boys are unalived, and now they'll never know a life without fear. The mothers and fathers gather outside the hospital and scream into the air because they couldn't give their boys a safe place to play. So that's the Boys of Summer 2014. So that was 10 years ago. And so seeing that poem again, it makes me incredibly sad. And that 10 years ago, I didn't know that much, as much as I know now, but I just knew that border walls are wrong. And, you know, attacking children in play, killing children in play is wrong. And I just want these safe places. And so with my new book, Incantation, it's called Incantation because a lot of the poems to me are like these imaginings of futures and these prayers for justice and peace. Mm-hmm. And so I'm going to read one of the poems from Incantation. And this one's called The Mermaid Game. And it was written for the children of Uvalde. And I was thinking about how, you know, imagining a safe place where the children of Uvalde are still alive and still playing and still loving each other. And like thinking about, and then I also, now I'm thinking about like next Benedict. And so I share this poem with them. I think about the children of Gaza and all their schools and what has happened to their schools. And so I want us all to imagine a place where schools are safe places for our children to grow and be nourished. And there is an epigraph, and this is from Alexis Pauline Grum's Undrowned. We are learning and relearning how to honor each other, how to go deep, how to take turns, how to find nourishing light again and again. The Mermaid Game. If I were a mermaid, my tail would sparkle pink and the shells covering perky breasts tart yellow. I would be forever summer like ice cream trucks and cherry slush, like two kids naively turning crisp under the shallows of a 3-foot pool. In the ocean, I'd swim, spin, full body, blowing bubbles. I'd dive below the weight of water to speak secrets only meant for you. Blue lips shaping, ah, wah, woo. And together we'd lap circles, building whirlpools, inviting rainbow fish to catch a ride. And not until I tired, drifted to the seafloor, laid my body across a rock, heard you say, I love you too. Could I dream of the undrowned children, never aged, brown, big-headed babies, alive in their schools, playing clams with cousins, learning numbers by octopus, all while being protected by whales and dolphins in a way they said they were always safe. and when I'd wake, I'd feed myself pineapple, do my stretches, squid ink dreams onto paper, making them real enough to be true, and tail to the surface to find you bathed in sunlight and us ready to go again. Thank you. So I'm going to leave it there for now.
So beautiful. And I'll have you read more at the end. You know, having you read those two poems, what's really interesting is the way that you merge beauty and horror. And like even the title of the poem you read from Posada, The Boys of Summer, right? It's very nostalgic. And then you're talking about this beautiful beach town, but you're also talking about these atrocities and they're coming to mind. And then when you read The Mermaid Game, the way it looks on the page, if people are following along, we're on page 13 of Incantation, page 12 and 13. The way it looks on the page is beautiful. And this idea is beautiful, but you're really talking about something really serious, right?
Yeah. Yes. The shape is supposed to look like a mermaid tail.
Yeah, it does. It does.
And then one of the things I was thinking about was that there was a young girl and a young boy classmates in Uvalde, and they were boyfriend and girlfriend. You know, they're just 10, they were just babies, yeah. You know, and that they would text each other, "I love you," every night. And their parents talked about that and shared that with the world. And so I was thinking about that, you know, that little new growing love.
Yeah, and even, you know, the way the book looks, it almost looks religious, right? You have the candle on the front, which looks like one of the, you know, the prayer candles that we have. But I'm assuming that's a picture of you and your family or you and your mother on the front on the candle.
Yeah, so the way the cover came about was that I take photos of everything, like my food, a pretty flower that I walk by, a cloud. A lot of them end up becoming reference photos. And when Maria Maloney, my publisher, asked what I wanted the cover to look like, I was like, "I don't know, how about this photo? How about that photo? How about this photo?" And then she said, "Well, maybe it's a collage." And so I thought, "Oh, I like collages." So I just took that opportunity to print up a bunch of my photos and create a collage. And then I handed that over to Maria, not knowing how it would be used or if it would be used. And then the cover designer, Cloud Delfina, they took that and took the collage's inspiration and created what you see. One of the things I love is that the color pink is very prominent on the cover.
Yes.
And that color came from the flowers in the collage. So I was like, that's really cool.
I mean, just the color in general, I usually don't, you know, talk much about covers, but your cover is so striking and it's so you, vibrant, you know, socially aware, like just, it's very lovely. And so they did a beautiful job, Mouthfield Press. I love all their collections, but I think they did an especially beautiful job with this book that you did, both the interior, how they did the spacing and the typeface and how they set it up. And then the exterior is beautiful.
So thank you. Yes, I'm very happy. And so I love this book. I thought Cloud did a beautiful job on the cover and Maria's work. And there was another person working on also on the layout. I think it's beautiful. So thank you.
Yeah. And, you know, one of my favorite series of poems. So we're going to talk a little bit later about how you organized your book. One of the favorite things that I do on this podcast is talk to people about sequencing, how, you know, because I like to get the hints about how people do it, like how you decide to organize a collection, how you decide to sequence it. All my favorite books are sequenced beautifully, all my favorite albums similarly. And I love how you put this book together and how you sequence it and how you divide it into the different sections. But there's these series of poems that talk about food and white spaces, right? Comfort food for white spaces. And a lot of them are set in Gettysburg, where you're doing like a retreat or a workshop or a residency. Talk about those poems. Like, they're so original because there's this contrast between you, the narrator, where you're in this space and you're in some uncomfortable situations, and yet you're comforting yourself with food, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So Yeah, the middle section are poems from a residency I did in Gettysburg National Military Park in fall 2017, which is a very specific time when you think about it, because Kaepernick was still on the 49ers and he was protesting Trump. It was the beginning of the Trump administration.
That's right.
He was constantly talking about Kaepernick. On top of that, in August 2017, there was the Unite the Right rally in Charlottesville, where all these white supremacists really felt themselves and were marching with these tiki torches.
Yeah.
Emboldened. And then Heather Heyer, who was part of the peaceful protest, was murdered because a white supremacist drove his car through peaceful protesters. So that was August. And then I was here at this Civil War site with over 1,100 monuments in September. And so it was a very unique time. It was a very scary time. It was a weird place to be and a weird time to be there. And then as like a woman of color, also solita by myself. So I was just dealing with a lot of discomfort. And so these pieces that you're talking about, Comfort Food for White Spaces, are these little like flash nonfiction pieces that I kind of enjoyed, genre bending. Like, this is a book of poetry, but let me throw some nonfiction in there. And they all have the same title, Comfort Food for White Spaces. Again, I was getting funky with myself. I love that.
Hybrid. It's kind of a hybrid technique, right?
Yeah. And I also love poems. I love collections that do this, that will have a series of poems about the same thing. Because we often think that like, oh, I have to say it the best way, the most original way, and then I can never say it again. You know, like, and it's not true. There's so many ways to look at something. So I love when a poetry collection kind of just stays in a space for a while and looks at it in different ways. And so that's what those are. And then the comfort food, I think the first one I wrote was, there's one about how this guy that I was seeing back in LA, and he dumps me and I eat SpaghettiOs. Mm-hmm. And like, SpaghettiOs are randomly very comforting to me, even though it's like this weird syrupy.
I grew up on them. Yeah.
And then, they come out of a can. It's like barely food. It's barely real food, but I find it very comforting. And so it started there. And then I was just kind of noticing that the comfort foods, all these weird stuff like buttig meat, which is like this, mm-hmm. like, again, barely a food, like this weird gray texture color. Yeah. Kind of spongy, like, it's like, I had Eggo waffles. So it was like all these like manufactured Americana food. And so it was just fun and interesting to like notice that I was being comforted by these weird Americana manufactured foods. And then it comes to the end, the final piece, then I'm like imagining my family's food at home and like ready to go home.
Beautiful. Yeah. I loved how they all fit together. What I did is I read the whole book twice and then I read those pieces together and they really did fit together. You have this one piece on page 47, where you say, "Tourists in a horse-drawn buggy watch me as display. I bite into the pink meat, let it slide down my throat." I mean, there's so much contrast here, and they're very poetic. And I did know they were nonfiction too. I don't know how, but I just knew that because I think that you're very adept at signaling. Not all writers can do that. But you do it really beautifully, where we kind of know who we are, who we're with when we're reading your writing.
Yeah, I still think of them as poems, mm-hmm. but they do have a lot. I mean, it is very personal essay, like flash personal essay, and very witness. I mean, a lot of my work is witness. This is what I'm seeing. This is how I'm feeling. I'm scared. It's like a lot of the poems. But I still also think about them. I still think of them as poetry. I just think that there's some gender bending, genre bending there. Mm-hmm. And having a little leeway with it and having a little fun with it.
Yeah. The other thing I really love about your writing, and I want to talk to you about how you organize this next, is the social justice aspect. It's very strong in this collection. You talk about a lot of people that have been killed, a lot of people who are struggling. Talk about how social justice plays a role in your writing and how you use your writing to make a difference in the world. I mean, you are really witnessing, and you know, I do a lot of that too. And I always love writers that engage in that, because I think it's more than being a writer. It's like being a social activist writer. It's a different, I love that label, and I would definitely label you as that as well. So how did you get into that? Was it just a natural, something you had a natural affinity for?
I think I've always had passion for social justice work. Mm-hmm. I think the origin of that is that my parents were children immigrants, and I always knew they were immigrants. And so immigrant rights, immigrant calls, I was always aware of and always interested in, even at a young age. You know, I didn't like that people thought about my parents negatively, right? I'm like, no, These are my parents and I love them and you're going to respect them. And so it started there. And then in high school, that's when I started learning about the Chicano movement, just like on my own, like going into the school library and finding a book on the Chicano movement. And so that also then like fed into my social justice passions. I think also like I loved the 60s. I loved the, you know, the peace movement of the 60s. Like these are all things that were like feeding me and informing me. I've always written poetry. I wrote my first poem at like 7 or 8. And then I was just always would write little things here and there. But it was when I was in college, in undergrad, I was taking a class that was a mix of the Asian American studies and the Chicano studies. There was like this like hybrid class with the two departments, and it was on immigrant rights. And in that class at Cal State Long Beach, that's when I learned about Angel Island, which is like the Ellis Island of the West Coast, sort of is what they call it. It's outside of San Francisco. It's in the bay up there. And it's kind of like Ellis Island because it's receiving people from the Asian countries, but it's not like Ellis Island because it wasn't a place to be welcomed. It was a place to be detained. So during the Chinese Exclusion Act in the first half of the 20th century, people would go to Angel Island trying to immigrate into the country, and they could be detained there for days, weeks, months. And most of them, I think, got sent back. Wow. So I learned about this in the class. And then in the barracks, and you can still see them today, people would graffiti poems on the barracks and carve into the barracks poems about how they were feeling, their witness poems of their time there. And that was like mind blowing to me. And I was like, there is this thing where that it's like these two parts of me, my poetry and my social justice passions, there's a place where they like combine. And I wrote a paper on that book and that history. And I was very proud of that. And that's really what sparked like me and how I see myself as a poet, was just finding that there was a place where these things met.
Yeah, and I definitely see you expanding as a writer. I love Posada. It's beautifully done. But I think when you take it here to incantation, you're like evolving where it is love poems for battle sites. It's merging the beauty of poetry with some of these really hard subjects that you're tackling. As well as identity, right? I mean, there's that poem, Learning the Hustle or To Be a Child of Immigrants. And it reminded me so much when I was in high school, you know, my best friend, Melinda, who I grew up with, who I'm best friends with to this day, her and Tracy, you know, her parents were from Mexico. She was born in Mexico. Her sisters were born here. But they came over and then they would go to the Remate, the swap meet every weekend. And sell like bicycle parts and stuff. And it was always like hustling, right? Always hustling, selling something or memorabilia or whatever it was. And it just was so nostalgic and beautiful for me that you're taking something, what some people, Sheree Moraga said this once at a reading that I heard her do, where you're taking something so ordinary and where not everyone will see the beauty in it, but the people who know, it will touch them so deep inside that they'll cry. Because you're like, I'm getting emotional now. You're capturing that, right? What that feels like to be around that.
Yeah, thank you for that. I think There's a couple of poems within the Gettysburg section. So the second section, the Gettysburg poems, all those poems were written, first drafts were written while I was there. So there's a poem, there's a poem about my father, you know, being drafted into the army. I think those poems had to come out of that space because I was such in a space of like, where do I belong? Being in this very white space, and then the history is like, do I even belong here? Where do I belong? What is my history? And so that's what those poems kind of came out of, was that those like, that kind of like sadness that I didn't see myself around me.
Yeah. You know, and I interviewed James Coates earlier today, who's his episode will air next week. And I was telling him that I had recently watched movie Lincoln, where Daniel Day-Lewis he plays Lincoln, because I had got to that through this movie about John Wilkes Booth that I was watching. And I was just so horrified by some of the language in it, but I think it was trying to be true to the time. And it just reminded me how much racism is still rampant, and how it could just goes in the criminal system, the carceral system I work within, there's a direct line back to bounty hunting and slavery, right? And so it was just, I had a really hard time watching those parts where you see a little child being taken over to the South from the North because, God forbid, she went to live with her uncle in the North who was a free man. And so it wasn't that long ago is what we need to remember. And the racism in some of these places is still very apparent, and mm-hmm. it's steeped and mm-hmm. it's entrenched. And the only way that you get rid of this stuff, I mean, this is my opinion as an abolitionist in the carceral system, is to redo it. I think you literally have to break it down and start over. But some people don't agree with that, and they think that you can manipulate or reform or whatever you want to call it. But what I think your book does is you're putting a spotlight on these issues, and you're doing it in a very subtle way. Like, you're not hitting us over the head with it. But I just think it's so important that you were in that place and you're feeling these things and you're writing about it.
Thank you. And I appreciate what you're saying as like an abolitionist and of the carceral system. Like, I think a lot of people are just afraid to even imagine. What do you mean defund the police? It's like, no one's saying get rid of, you know, it's like, what do you mean get rid of prisons? What do you mean get rid of borders? It's like, I don't know. Why don't we try? Why don't we just try to imagine that? Because to me, you know, current day racism, so much is tied to property, mm-hmm. and borders and city lines and walls. And it's like, what if there was no wall? What if there wasn't this border between Mexico and here? What would that look like? Right. What do you mean? I don't know.
Does it have to be us or them? Why can't we all be citizens of the global state? I mean, I don't know how it would work, but I do know within the carceral system, the first step is getting rid of bail, getting rid of bail bondsmen, getting rid of people, economics playing such a role, right? And what I learned from Lincoln, it reminded me of how failed Reconstruction was, and that led to some of the policies we have now, and what the criminal system became is another form of slavery, right? And it was a way to impose this kind of shackles on Black and brown bodies. Yeah. And it persists to this day. And whether it's ICE or whether it's the police, I mean, not to say there's not good ones. I mean, I'm never an absolute, like I never deal in absolutes. I work in a courtroom and I have a deputy protect me all day long. He's a great deputy. He's very kind, gentle with my clientele who are very sick in the mental health system. But they call my clients bodies. The fact that they say bring up the bodies, the pure dehumanization of that is so obvious just in the word choice. And that's what I mean by you're pointing some of these things out that we don't want to remember. Like, we don't want to remember how many people have died at the hands of police. We don't want to remember that the water in Flint is still dirty. We don't, and you have a poem about that. We don't want to remember these things, right?
Yeah. Yeah. And so I think what I think, you know, what I'm trying to do with this book is create a space where let's talk about it, right? And also there's this idea of trying again. Again is a word that comes up a lot in the book. And it's because it's like, I'm going to get this wrong. You might get this wrong. We're going to get this wrong. It's okay. Let's just keep trying. Let's try again. Let's try again. So it's not easy to talk about these things, especially in the world we live in now with social media. You know, everyone's afraid of saying the wrong thing. It's like, you know, so, like it's better to say something than to say nothing. So that's in the book. And then just to like imagine, like I also don't know what it would look like. I don't know what it would look like, but I want to try to imagine. I want to dream of it. And that's what the mermaid game is, right? Like I want to imagine a place where kids are safe in their schools. Like, you know, why aren't they safe in their schools right now? Like in our world, they aren't. And so I'm going to imagine that. And it's just like it's an invitation for people to say the hard things. And it's also an invitation for folks to dream.
Yeah. And dream is important. I mean, kind of imagination's important. Being a visionary is important. Talk about how you structured the book for those writers who are, you know, kind of struggling with how to structure their own manuscript, whether it's poetry or prose. How did you decide to structure this into three sections? You use quotes at the beginning of each section. You use one of my favorite people, Sheree Moraga, in here as a quote, loving in the war years. Talk about that, like the structure and the sequencing. Did it come naturally out like this, or did you kind of play with it, decide where to put certain poems, move them around? How do you work as a writer? Like, are you more organic or more organized? I'm organic. I'm a pantser, fly by the seat pantser. I'm not an organized person that does outlines or anything like that.
So I'm a Taurus. So I do like things to be like, have their comfy little places and everything to have their spots. With this book, the first part that got, well, the first section that was a section was the Gettysburg poems. And that's because after that experience, I was like, okay, I have 20 poems. That's a chapbook. And I don't think I've ever written a chapbook before. So a chapbook is like a 20-page collection of poetry, or it can also be, there can also be a short story chapbook. You can also have essay chapbook, but it basically it's a smaller book. And I like chapbooks because they're kind of ephemeral. They're smaller. Also, that work gets to have two lives, because in the rules of publishing, a lot of times you can't publish something twice, but that does not include chapbooks. So you can create a chapbook, which is a mini book, and then you can use that mini book in the larger book, and it can have two lives. And so a full length has to be at least 40 pages. These are just the like publishing rules, right? Like I didn't make it up, and I also, you know, take it for what it's worth.
Yeah. And now people are playing with the genre of chapbooks and making it longer or shorter, you know? Yeah. That's what's weird. Everything's changing. But I really like how you explain that. Go ahead. Sorry for interrupting you.
No, it's okay. So I thought, okay, I have these 20 poems. I can make a chapbook. And then I thought it would be easier to publish a chapbook. So I was like, oh, I'll get to something sooner if I make the chapbook, and I'll get published sooner. Well, that didn't turn out to be true. It's just as hard to publish a chapbook as it is to publish anything else. You know, there was a lot of rejections. And then I finally, it did get published with this really cool opportunity through AB Art Projects, which is an art gallery in the Bendix building in downtown LA. And it was part of this exhibit with other women who submit folks. They asked us for our chapbooks. Sculptors read our chapbooks. A sculptor read my chapbook and then created like a bookshelf, sculpted a bookshelf that was themed with my chapbook. And then we had like an exhibit. So I got to interact with the gallery, the publisher, the printer, the sculptor, the curator. And it was just really fulfilling and beautiful. It's like, here I am chasing these big contests, these big credits, trying to make myself, you know, big and important. And it was lonely and sad. And then this opportunity came where I got to be in community with people, and it was beautiful. So that was a big eye-opening thing for me. Like, you know, it just showed me there are other ways to be fulfilled in publishing. So it started there. And then I thought, oh, if I start small, it'll be easy to branch out. I thought it'd be easier to grow the full collection. That also did not turn out to be true. So like, I had, the chapbook was published in December 2019 with AB Projects. And then there was like two, and then the pandemic hit, right?
Right.
And there was at least 2 more years of like, not really anything. Like, you know, we were in the pandemic, but then by like towards the end of 2021, there were books coming out, new books that were talking about the pandemic. And I'm like, what? How are people doing this? Like, I better get on my game. Like, I better do something. By then it had been like 5-6 years since Posada. And I was kind of feeling like, well, crap, I better put something together. And so that's what happened. And then what I do is I find a contest and I use that deadline as a goal.
That's great.
Yeah. So I think I found a contest that it was like May 2022 was the deadline. And I was like, okay, I'm going to put this thing together. I'm going to put it together. And I had all these poems. I had been writing the whole time, but there's no through line. It's just stuff. It's all in piles. I don't know. There's these pandemic poems. There's these uprising poems. There's these, you know, Instagram poems I made. There's always going to be romantic dude poems, broken heart poems. So there's those. And I was like, well, how does all of this go together? So then that became really difficult, actually, because I was like, could not figure out how to do that. And then also what was made it difficult was that I had the Gettysburg stuff, which I felt was really strong. And I felt spoke to each other. Like all those pieces in the Gettysburg capsule, I think speak really well to each other. And when you read them all together, you get like a full picture of what that experience was like. And so that was exciting. And I liked that. But then it was like, what do I do with the rest of it? How do I make more, you know? So then it just became like looking at everything I had and kind of taking inventory and then just trying combinations and also calling, because I had so much. So that like the first time I put it together for that first contest, it was probably at least 30 pages longer than what it ended up being. And so I sent it to that first contest just so I have the deadline. I know I'm not going to win. You know, there's less than a 1% chance of winning any contest in the literary world. So I'm like, I'm going to send it. I just need a deadline. It's not going to win. When it doesn't win, I will revise it again. And so that's what I did. And I really appreciate when people talk about the structure because it took a lot of work. I revised this probably at least 5 times, just looking at order. And, you know, I wanted the Gettysburg. I decided the Gettysburg was going to be the middle. And then it was going to be like an engagement ring. So it was going to be like the center setting. Mm. And then we were going to have complementary settings. And so then I decided that. But then I was like, I was always really concerned that the other two sections wouldn't raise up to the strength of the Gettysburg stuff. So I was just always constantly reordering, culling work. Oh, these two things say kind of the same thing. Okay, this one says it better. So I'm going to keep this one. I'm going to get rid of the other one. Okay, let me reorganize. And just constantly doing that, thinking about mixing hard and soft. Like you're saying, I have fun things. There's humor. And then there's also a lot of hard topics. So just trying to figure out how to weave those together in a way that felt. One thing I think about is I don't want to leave people in a hard place. Mm-hmm. Like I want to take you somewhere difficult, but then I want to bring you back too. So that kind of thing is what, those are the kind of things I was thinking about.
Yeah. You have to have those bombs. You know, I use humor in a lot of my work to kind of, as the bomb. You use this beautiful kind of just, you know, you give us the reckoning, then you like, you give us a little massage. You know, I think people discount how much organization matters and how much work actually goes. When I wrote my memoir, I was done with it at year 10. I had all the stories. The question was, how is I going to order it? How do you get rid of the repeats? How do you structure it? What's the threads you're going to use? Same thing in poetry. I think I spent a year or two revising my collection, and people like Liz did a little work with me on repetition. Liz Gonzalez, shout out to her. She's a Macondista as well.
Yay, Liz.
Yay, Liz. And so I think that for you to talk very straightforward about how you did it, I think it's important for writers to know. It's my favorite part of this podcast. I learned how people put stuff together and how much work really goes into it.
Yeah, and I start by, like, I print it all out and I put everything out on the floor. And it's so funny because it's like every time I have to reteach myself, you know. So the first time I did that with this book, I did that and I was like, well, now what am I supposed to do? Like, okay, now what? I was really confused. I think with the first book, I thought a lot about themes and motifs. And so I did a lot of work of like pairing things that way. This book, I felt so many things at the beginning, everything just felt really separate, really like there was just really big terrain. And so I couldn't do that. And then I just started thinking like, okay, well, here are the April 2020 stuff. Okay, well, what can I pair April 2020 stuff? And
yeah,
and just kind of slowly looking at different projects I would do.
And, you know, I love that motif that you use of the wedding ring. It really does feel like that. Like it really does flow really well. And it really is well-rounded. We really feel the circular nature of it. And you just did a beautiful job doing it. So brava to you.
Thank you.
It's a really beautiful.
I really was like honed in on. I didn't want anything to feel not as important as the rest. And I really wanted it to feel even. And I really wanted things to feel connected. I think I was also really scared because of all the romantic love poems.
Oh, I love that stuff. Oh my gosh. I love romance though. So.
and I have some erotic poems. And I was really scared of like that. Like, how does that then pair with, you know, your talk? You mentioned I have a poem that talks about Flint. I have a poem, you know, I have poems from the like 2020 uprising. So it's like, how do I put these things in the same space? You know? So I was concerned about that.
But they go together, oddly enough. I think it's that love and battlefield kind of feel that I got from them where I didn't feel they were discordant. I feel they worked with it. Right. So yeah, beautifully done. I do want you to talk a little bit, and you touched on a lot of hints for writers. You are the director of one of my favorite nonprofit organizations, Women Who Submit. Talk about how Women Who Submit has influenced you both as a writer. It's your pretty much your day job as the director. If you want to give them a little shout out, and then talk about the anthology you just put out as well. People should go get that. It's called Transformation, a Women Who Submit anthology. Sochi is in it as well as being the director of the organization. I'm in it. A lot of other people are in it. Tisha Reikley Aguilera, Tony Ann Johnson, Carla Samath, who's the poet laureate of Arcadia. A lot of well-known writers are in here.
Yeah. So Women Who Submit, just a little bit about that. It was co-founded in 2011. So we've been around for over 10 years. And that it was started with myself and two other writers, Alice Dixon and Ashaki M. Jackson. And in 2009, VITA, Women in Literary Arts, which is an organization still around, they did a study of the top tier journals. So like The Atlantic, The New Yorker, Paris Review, those types of journals. They did a study of how many women were being published in those pages in comparison to how many men, and also how many books by women were being reviewed in comparison to how many books by men were being reviewed. And they published that study, and what it showed was clear evidence of a huge disparity, gender disparity in publishing. So that was 2009, and then they started going to editors and saying, hey, do you know that this is happening? Why is this happening? And editors would say that women didn't submit as often or as aggressively as men. And so they weren't getting as many, they weren't getting as much quality work or work, not even quality. They weren't getting as much work from women writers. So that was the issue that Women Who Submit was created to answer. And
It
started with submission parties. And we would hang out in each other's homes, and we would bring our journals and our computers and our work. And we'd start by saying like, hey, what do people want to do today? And they'd be like, I'm going to submit to, Paris Review. I'm going to submit to the Macondo workshop. I'm going to submit to community of writers, I'm going to submit to The Atlantic, whatever, you know, and we would all share that information. And then more, then we would learn about these things too. Oh, Macondo, I've never heard of that. What's that? Oh yeah. Well, you know, and then you would share all that stuff. And that's how it started. We also used to share food. We, back in the day, they were still doing mail. So we would have a printer and envelopes. Mm-hmm. And people could, like, you know, send their work off right then. Yeah. And so that's how it started. And since the pandemic, we haven't been able to meet in people's homes. It kind of feels like passe to do. Plus the organization is like 400 people just like in the LA area. So it's like, how can I invite pretty much strangers into someone's house post pandemic? So we haven't been able to get back to that, but I love it. Nowadays, the programming is, we do a speaker series. We do a quarterly speaker series. We just had Carmen Jimenez from Grey Wolf talk to us with Louis Valresto. That was like 2 weeks ago. And that was thanks to Angela Franklin, who is our Women Who Submit West LA chapter lead. So we have chapters. Chapters all across the country, one in Europe, I think one coming in Canada. We have a team of chapter directors with Lucy Rodriguez Hanley and Thea Puchel. So yeah, so we have a team to work on that. And yeah, we do a speaker series. We're going to have a summer workshop, a free summer workshop for folks who, you know, summer workshops like Macondo, like community writers, like Vona. These things can be expensive and competitive. So we offer every 2 years, we offer a free online version for folks. And we have a great lineup of faculty. And that's going to be open. The deadline for that, to apply for that, is like April 20th, I think, somewhere around there.
Wow.
Yeah. And so, yeah, those are the things we're doing over there. And like, how does it inform my writing?
Let me just say, though, huge accomplishment, both as a writer, a literary citizen, and that you built this huge organization. But yeah, I mean, I guess you really show women how to value their voices, right?
I hope women and non-binary writers, yeah, I want, and then also because I'm a person, because I got this from my mother, I'm always going to be like by example, right? So I'm always submitting to things. I mean, I guess lately I'm just kind of tired of it, so I haven't put that much effort in, but that's why submission parties were good. Like at the Carmen Jimenez talk, we had an in-person submission party afterward at Avenue 50. And I got like three things out. And I'm like, oh, right. We do need these submission parties.
No, they work, Sochi. The last one that you guys did where I was coming in online and listening to people, I submitted to like a radio show that I had already submitted to before. But I was like, I have this story about making tortillas and I'm a pochette. So why not just try it? I'll use the title for my book and do a riff on that and use it as a marketing thing. And I got accepted. Yeah. They still haven't paid me like 3 months later, but yeah. But whatever, I don't really do it for the money, but I think that those kinds of things work. I don't know what it is. It's like Weight Watchers for me. Like I have to have that community for me to
accountability.
Really.
Yeah. Accountability buddies, someone to clap for you. Like, cause it's kind of annoying work, like selling yourself, putting yourself out there. Like I said, you know, these contests, you have less than a 1% chance. And so it can get to be a real drag. And so it's nice to have people with you, doing it with you.
Yeah. And I love how you talk about sharing your successes, but also sharing your failures. I was just talking to James Coates about this, who's a poet. And he was telling me that he always shares his failures on social media because too many people just share the successes. And so it's kind of nice to hear, oh, this person didn't get into that, but they got into that. They didn't get that grant, but they got this. You know, it's not all successes. Cause I mean, you would know this probably, like when you submit, like what percentage is it? Like 10% only gets accepted of whatever you put out there?
I've heard that if you're getting like 10% acceptance, you're doing pretty good.
Okay. That's good.
That's actually like a good, that means you're doing pretty well. So I would say probably average might be less than that.
Yeah, you know, I wrote my memoir by sending out short story memoir pieces to different journals, and then that's how I did it. I did what you did, which is a great hint, which is either have a journal or a deadline or something and use that as the impetus to finish whatever you're working on. But the hard part of that is putting all that stuff together and pulling it down can take a couple of years. But I think that, you know, it's really encouraging to hear someone like you just talk about like the nuts and bolts of it, about being a writer.
Yeah. And rejection, I mean, rejection is part of it. It's just, and so you have to find ways to use it. So like I said, with my book, I was like, okay, I'm going to apply to that grant. I mean, not that grant. I'm going to apply for that contest. I'm not going to get it. I know that. But then I'll revise it. At least there's something. At least there's something to work with. And so for rejection, for me, a lot of times it's just a prompt to revise again. It's like, okay, let me rework it. Let me rework it. Let me send it out again. And, you know, Macondo, which we're both Macondistas, I got rejected from Macondo at least twice, maybe a third time before I got in. And I got in from the wait list. And I was at a reading recently with Tisha. Shout out to Tisha Marie Reckley Aguilera. She organized a reading in Long Beach. And somebody at that reading was like, oh, it's so nice to hear that you were rejected. And I'm like, yeah. And I still, and you know, and I got in from the wait list. So it's like, you can't let those things stop you. They're just got to be, you got to find ways to use them as motivators.
For sure. For sure. Same thing with Vona. You know, I think I got rejected my first year, got in the second year, Macondo, same kind of thing. Well, actually I didn't apply. I kind of sabotaged myself for many years. Liz had asked me to apply and I said, I don't think I'll get in. I don't think I'm enough. I don't feel comfortable. Like, that I'm even worthy. And so you do have to believe in yourself and you do have to be willing to take that rejection on. And I'll say this, you know, I've learned so much more from sometimes when I don't get something versus when I get it. You know, it's great to get stuff and to be offered opportunities. But I think also being part of the literary citizen and being in your community with others, they're going to gift you stuff anyways. You know, I've had so many people gift me stuff. Just from doing this podcast, opportunities, readings, events. Before we get into the last part of the reading, which I'd like to make one request. I love the poem, The Last White Man I Loved, which is on page 65. I just think your sense of humor is so evident right there. The Last White Man I Tried to Love. Let me fix that. If you could read at least that poem for me. And then tell people where to find you, where to find your work, where to find Women Who Submit, how to take a class with you or Women Who Submit. Just for people who are listening in also, if you go to the Life of Gem Facebook page and you follow me and then you DM me a poem, I can share it on this podcast and I will also send out 2 copies of Incantation, Love Poems Thank for Battle you. Sites.
That's so amazing.
People listening in, do that, please. Okay.
Thank you for doing that. Also, shout out to, you mentioned our anthology, Transformation, Women Who Submit. We have a series of anthologies. So I love this because we're not only pushing people out to send their work out, we're also publishing ourselves, which I think is very important because there's a reason why this we're serving this marginalized group. It's not happening. So, okay, let's do it for ourselves. Buy us, for us kind of thing, right? And so the anthology Transformation is beautiful. There's 42 contributors and we're having a party April 13th in West LA. So if you're in the West LA area, we're going to be at Plummer Park at 2:00. We have a DJ, we're getting food. Hopefully we'll have some people tabling and we're going to have books for sale and we're going to have readers. So April 13th, 2 p.m., Plummer Park. Come and hang out with us and celebrate with us.
Yay.
Yeah. And then for my book, you can find it, and both books, actually, you can find them with our partner, Libro Mobile, Sarah Rafael Garcia, out in Santa Ana. She is an indie bookseller that we adore and support. Amazing. And she is selling Transformation, and she also is selling, she did an exclusive pre-sales for my book Incantation. So she's also working with Mouthfeel, my publisher. So yeah, check out Libro Mobile. They have a book, what is it called? Bookshop. They have a bookshop online. But then there's also a brick and mortar spot out in Santa Ana that is a beautiful space. Oh my gosh. Oh. Check her out.
Stunning. Yeah. If anyone hasn't been to Libro Mobile in Santa Ana, go out there. Check out Sarah Rafael Garcia's books, too. She's a beautiful writer. I love her memoir, and I love her Santa Ana fairy tales genre thing that she did.
Oh, and for me, I'm the easiest way to find me is Instagram, at Xochitl Julissa. I have two first names. And everything is Xochitl Julissa. So like my email is Xochitl Julissa. My website is Xochitl Julissa. So just Google Xochitl Julissa Bermejo and you will find me if you want. And the last white man I tried to love, right? By what is it called? Because you asked for what's it called?
Oh, dedicate for Winnie, a request.
A request, thank you. By request. And so this is one of the Gettysburg poems. And this was, one of the reasons it's love poems or battle sites, because during that time I was in a situationship. I'm kind of known for them. It's just my thing. And with this record shop owner out here in LA. So this is about that.
All you had to say was record shop owner.
The last white man I tried to love. I called the cocktails he mixed, the cigarettes he rolled, the steak dinners he treated to me to reparations, and did my best to ignore the fact we only drank gin, even though he knew I preferred whiskey, or that we went for sushi only when I insisted. In the evenings, he sat in his armchair with me at his side on the couch as we read from separate books. You fit right into my life, he said, lifting a pointed nose from pages. Later, that nose buried between my legs as he studied my lips, sucked on my swells until I came loud. Good girl, he said. One night, I read him a passage aloud from Loving in the War Years about women like me needing attention and care. I did not read what it said about men like him. And don't I care for you? He asked. Yes, I said, knowing the real answer, he probably didn't care to hear. Once he set me up in his office with a fresh martini and left me alone to write. Later, he brought me a plate of heated frozen lasagna and said, I like you in my space. That night, my clothes stayed on. I went home early for a job the next day, and I was thrilled by all of this. But then he started playing records just for himself by 20th century white men seeking island fantasy and flavor. When I asked, what are you listening to? He said, exotica. I heard erotica. It sounds pretty fetishy to me, I said, but he didn't get it. He never did. I didn't get any that night. And when I brought him a square of tres leches cake and a mango chili lollipop, leftovers from a family party he had no intention of attending and didn't try either, I wasn't surprised. Still, I didn't stop offering him all of me, and he didn't stop taking only what he liked. Mm.
Don't date a writer. They just might write about you.
Yeah.
I mean, you say so much. We've all been there, right? I mean, I haven't been there for like 20 years, but actually 30, but I remember those situationships. So beautifully done.
Thank you. Do you want me to read a couple more? Or
yes, please. Please, please, please. We got a couple more minutes. Read a couple more poems and we'll say our goodbyes. And just so everyone knows, this is going to release. Today's Monday, March 18th. This is going to release this week. So share it, please.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. I'm going to read another one from Posada, Offerings of Witness and Refuge. So I consider myself a witness poet, an experiential poet. And one of the projects I did in Posada was that I volunteered with No More Deaths, a humanitarian border aid organization in the Tucson sector of the border. And I went out for like 10 days and was witness to the border, gave humanitarian aid, put water. One of the main things you do is you put water gallons out on migrant trails so that people can, it's a life-giving water. People need water. And they ask you to draw or write a message because a lot of times Border Patrol will mess with the water they'll spill it out, they'll slash, and you'll see slashed containers out there that they slash and spill out. So we write messages so that they know that they're safe. And I started drawing Virgins, the Virgen de Guadalupe, like a little line drawing with my Sharpie. And so this is about that. Our Lady of the Water Gallons, un mensaje a mis compañeros, Aravaca, Arizona. I etch black line Sharpie Virgenes on plastic water gallons. One arc, ictus in the sand at traveler's feet. One post carving, hobo's mark on the road. The Virgen speaks to faceless shadows traveling when the land is dark. I etch black line Sharpie Virgenes on plastic water gallons. One arc is the bridge between LA and Aravaca, liquor store murals and water drawings, dogs on lawns and dogs trained to attack a man and woman darting up Hippie Mountain. They've hiked this far from Guatemala on one plastic water gallon, one arc. Ictus in the sand at traveler's feet is the tale of a man left shirtless and shoeless beside thorny mesquite. Como un pez sin agua, he has fished off the road, limp and nearly witless. In the arms of compañeros, he asks, ¿Es esto sentir la muerte? Barely conscious, he is Ictus in the sand at traveler's feet. One post-carving hobo's mark would mark our angel food with a cross. But cross signs feel wrong to fingers wanting a symbol with less power, more loss, like desert flower blooms or a growing belly beneath blue robes of water and gloss. I need one post-carving, hobo's mark. On the road, the Virgen speaks to faceless suffering. A woman 7 months pregnant hikes with garlic-lashed calves, snake safeguard. Bleeding and cramping, body bent to ground, she makes mud salves and prayers to our mother. Keep my unborn daughter radiant. On the road, the Virgen speaks. To faceless shadows traveling when the land is dark, I say I see the fresh footprint in the riverbed, the torn blanket ditched on the hillside. At a rest stop shaded by oak, I tread slow, count empty gallons, read what remains. I promise you are not invisible nor discarded, people traveling when the land is dark. I etch black line Sharpie Virgenes to cloak rocky paths and stars and hope one will guide you home. When muscle spasms and farm lights appear too far, know that I built this poem with safe spaces. But because no words can erase your scars, I etch black line Sharpie Virgenes. Wow. Thank you.
Oh my gosh, when you read that, the musicality of it, the repetition, the images that you create, it's so beautiful. Can you do one more last?
Yes. So I wanted to read that one because this next one references that poem. And so this is in my new book, and a project of witness and experience that I did there was the Gettysburg. And I kind of realized, like, apparently I like to put myself in really uncomfortable positions and then write about it. So this is a poem from Gettysburg. And again, I kind of like call back to the water gallons and the Virgen in this poem. Battlegrounds. Motorcycles and white tour vans speed between behemoth granite shafts, shove my body by their force, leave me roadside and wandering fields. Nothing is funny when you're Chicana and walking a Civil War site not meant for walking. Regardless, I ask park rangers and guides for stories on Mexican soldiers, receive shrugs. No evidence in statues or statistics. In the cemetery, not one Spanish name. I'm alone in the gift shop. It's the same in the post office, the market, the antique shop with the KKK books on display. In the peach orchard, I prepare a seance, sit cross-legged in grass and hold a smoky quartz to the setting sun. I invite the unseen to speak. So many dead, it said Confederates were left to rot. In war, not all bodies are returned home nor graves marked. I Google Mexicans in the Civil War and uncover layers to the Treaty of Guadalupe Hidalgo and Cinco de Mayo. This is how I meet ancestors for the first time. Heroes this country decorates in clownish sombreros and fake mustaches. Dishonors for fighting European empire on shared American land. Power and money dictate can't be shared. Years before this, carrying water gallons up an Arizona mountain ridge to replenish supplies in a past known as Dead Man's, I wrote messages on bottles to the living, scanned Sonoran canyons for the lost, and knew too many would not be found. A black Sharpie Virgen drawn on hot plastic became a prayer. May the next officer halt before cracking her face beneath his boot, spilling life onto dirt. No, nothing's funny when you're brown in a country you're taught isn't yours. Your dead don't count.
Mm. Wow. That's one of my favorite poems. And I didn't catch that it harkens back where you do the callback to the other poem from Posada. Beautiful. Beautiful. Thank you.
Thank you. Oh.
Your poetry is so beautiful. Well, it's hard to say goodbye, but we must. But it's been an honor to have you on, Xochitl. Thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you for having me. I loved being here. I loved chatting with you. And it's always it's always great to have a chance to chat with you.
Great, great. So I'm going to say bye, everyone. Stick around for 1 second after. And bye, everyone. Have a great day.